Spirit Blade Underground, episode 267. Warning, access restricted. Please submit to DNA verification. Processing. Verification complete. Access granted. Welcome. Audio file encryption processing. Transmission decoded. Begin playback for system file. Spirit Blade Underground, episode 267.
Hello and welcome to the Monitor Room at the Spirit Blade Underground podcast, a biblical examination and celebration of geekery and geek entertainment. I'm Peter Franson from Spirit Blade Productions, where we produce entertainment and resources designed to equip, encourage, and inspire Christian geeks like you and me to live more and more for Christ. For more information, free goodies, and a great online community, check out spiritblade.net. On the show today, the summer of free begins with Path of Exile. Hack and slash gamers, stay tuned if you haven't heard of this one. Plus a conversation between me and Matt McKinney, contributor of our Trek Talk segment, as we talk about Star Trek Into Darkness, comparing our thoughts about that movie and also about Star Trek things in general. And finally, a brief history of Doctor Who and a review of an audio drama featuring the Good Doctor by Professor Allen. Lots of good show today. Let's get to it.
Rejoice, ye penny-pinching nerds! Rejoice! For this is a season unbound by our bank accounts, unfettered by fees. A legendary age of liberty, this is the summer of free!
Yes, the summer of free is here, and this year I'm launching the summer of free with what may just be the best free content we'll feature all summer long. I hate to risk other summer of free segments being anticlimactic after this one, but I've been chomping at the bit to share this review since February, and am I saying that February or February? I know it's spelled February. Does anybody really say February, or do we say February? I don't know. Back then, I've been chomping at the bit since then to share this review, and hopefully you'll be grateful that I gave you an early start on this one as early as possible if you haven't heard of it already. Okay, so what's all this buildup leading to? Well, like I implied earlier, PC hack and slash gamers, rejoice, for we have been given Path of Exile. The description at pathofexile.com reads, Path of Exile is an online action RPG set in the dark fantasy world of Rayclast. We're a small independent team of hardcore gamers based in New Zealand and have created Path of Exile as the game that we'd want to play ourselves. It is designed around a strong, barter-based online item economy, deep character customization, competitive PvP, and ladder races. The game is completely free and will never be pay-to-win. Path of Exile is currently in open beta. If you'd like to play, just create an account. You'll notice immediately when you begin that Path of Exile is a Diablo clone in the most obvious and loving sense. The developers are clearly fans of previous Diablo games. They've stated on their site, "We listened to the fan communities of several popular online action RPGs as we designed Path of Exile and are focused on replayability, depth, and accessibility," said Chris Wilson, Grinding Gear Games founder. "We've designed the game that we would want to play ourselves, and we know hardcore Diablo, Titan Quest, and Dungeon Siege players will find the style familiar and addictive." In fact, Path of Exile has been so well received by the gaming community that there are a number of comparative reviews to be found online pitting the game against Diablo 3, not as a free alternative, but as a potentially superior game in its own right, regardless of price. Now, speaking of price, it may sound too good to be true that a potential Diablo killer is genuinely 100% free. You know, what's the catch, right? Well, as explained on the Path of Exile website, Path of Exile is 100% free to play for everyone forever. Our website will allow the purchase of many in-game perks, and aesthetic upgrades, but all of these are completely optional, and players can have a complete, fulfilling gaming experience without spending a penny. There is no catch at all. Once you download the client, you are free to play for as long as you like with no charge. The purchasable perks do not convey any gameplay benefit, but help you create a unique look for your character and its fighting style. We won't be selling any form of power in the game, only aesthetic improvements. So if you're fighting someone, you know they earned their place the hard way. Now, I can add from personal experience that the game is indeed 100% free. In fact, I haven't even been remotely tempted to spend money on the cosmetic upgrades available, which add new attack, spell, and ability animations. I'm actually amazed the business model seems to be working for them. I mean, I don't know that that's the case, but so far it seems to be. Speaking of the cosmetic, the game looks fantastic, even on the run-of-the-mill laptop I usually play the game on. And when I fire it up on my more capable desktop PC, it looks stunning. The world of Rayclast is a dark, hellish corner of the universe I'd never want to spend time in, but love fighting my way through from the safety of my home. The game seems to scale its performance well depending on the power of the system I use. The action seems a little slower on my laptop, though no less enjoyable despite not having quite as smooth a frame rate. In fact, most of the time I play Path of Exile, it is on my laptop. The designers comment on system requirements by saying, "Path of Exile is designed to run on a huge variety of systems, from an everyday laptop to a top-of-the-line gaming rig. Our detailed art is designed to not only look great, but also reveal additional detail as the resolution is increased to the maximum 2560 by 1600. Exact system requirements will be determined closer to release. At the moment, you will need a graphics card with pixel shader 3.0 or higher and a CPU that supports SSE2. At least 2 gigabytes of RAM is recommended, and older integrated graphics cards will not run well." So, it looks great, is free with no catch, and works on a variety of Windows computers. But how does the game actually play? You know, is it fun? Well, the short answer is that if you like Diablo and similar action RPGs, you're crazy not to give this one a try. It's unlikely you'll be disappointed. Great point-and-click hack-and-slash action that might feel a little slow at the beginning as your character is in their first few levels, but that ramps up into a sweet spot of responsiveness after just a few levels. Now, there are some key differences to Diablo that are worth mentioning. First is the skill system. As your character levels up, they can upgrade passive abilities on a massive skill tree. People online have jokingly referred to it as the skill forest. And it's going to look really intimidating at first. You're going to be like, "What the crap do I do with this?" Don't let that intimidate you. Just as you get points, just look at where they start you off and just start punching in, you know, and just advancing yourself however you want. Now, I've heard that in the later game, you know, that like hardcore players who want to build the perfect guy, they might be frustrated with the experience later and realize that to do what they want, they have to go back and start the game over. But I'm sure that you can also find a ton of build guides online. I mean, it's definitely all about kind of how you build your character. And I'm sure there are obsessive gamers that have figured out the best ways to do it. Let's see here. So anyway, this massive skill tree that you have, it's all passive abilities that you're upgrading. So increased hit points, increased mana, defense, etc., all that stuff. Actual combat abilities are found in gems that can be socketed into weapons and armor. Gems gain levels as you use them as well, just like you gain levels. So the combat abilities at your disposal are similar to what you're going to find in other action RPGs, but tying them to items means that any class can use any skill and makes the game more loot-driven. And if you're a looter, you're going to love this game. It's all about the loot. In fact, in a bold stroke that initially concerned me but soon fascinated me and I now find really enjoyable, the developers have removed any kind of currency from the game. So there's no gold, no jewels, no diamonds, there's nothing. There's no currency. Transactions with merchants and other players online are entirely based on barter and the items in your inventory. And also, no real-world money enters the equation either. The developers state on their site, "Path of Exile does not have a gold-based currency. Instead, you occasionally find valuable currency items, of different rarities that allow you to modify your equipment. You can either spend these items to improve your character, trade them with other players or NPCs, or hold on to them for later use. Now, to clarify, each of these types of what they call currency items is also a practical item that can be used by your character in some way, or becomes a practical item when you get, say, 10 of them. Like, I think if you find 10 scroll fragments, when you know, which you can use in trading as kind of a currency item, when you get a stack of, like, I don't know, 10 of them or something, they become a town portal scroll or an identify scroll, you know. So you can use these currency items for their built-in benefit, or as currency in trading, whichever you prefer. Handling currency this way, I've found, adds depth of strategy to the game and makes looting more interesting, even when you aren't finding uncommon or rare items, because you're looking at these currency items and saying, okay, it's not just cash. I look at my inventory and say, well, do I want to hang on to this? Do I want to use this as cash or hang on to it because my stack is almost ready to have these turn into an item that I can use? So it just adds interesting choices and strategy and thought to the game. Potions are also handled differently, using a refillable flask system. Instead of potion bottles vanishing after use, you know, so you're filling up your inventory with tons and tons of potions. No, you only get, you know, a few of them maybe, and they're simply depleted partially as you drink from them, and they're eventually emptied. And potion flasks are refilled as you kill enemies, whether it's a health potion or a mana potion flask or whatever potion, they get refilled as you're killing enemies. The developers say that this choice was made to avoid having players fill their inventories with health potions and simply spam them to be victorious in battle. I'm sure that makes sense. I haven't quite seen what the difference is yet in my own personal play style. Maybe that's just because I haven't ever done that, spammed, you know, an inventory full of potions before. So I haven't felt that difference, but maybe you will, or maybe just by hearing that description, you can already see in your head how that would change gameplay. So, but that's not something that's really affected my play style much at all. There are 6 available character classes, including Marauder, Ranger, Duelist, Witch, Templar, and Shadow. Now, I only have experience with the Marauder, which plays like a barbarian. And I think just from the names, you can tell what those other ones probably represent. Or, you know, a ranger is going to be, you know, a ranger. They're going to have ranged ability and some melee ability. A duelist, I think, is all about weapons, but I can't remember. Witch, you know, that's like your magic user. Templar, that's like your fighter slash, you know, holy magic, healing magic type thing, I think. And Shadow, I think that's like a thief assassin type thing. Now, PvP is available in the game, but I only have experience with the PvE campaign, which I have played solo. Path of Exile is not an MMO. And that's really valuable to me as a Summer of Free gamer, because I normally don't play MMOs. And so when I look at MMOs to consider for mentioning on the Summer of Free, I'm looking for MMOs that solo well, that can scratch that normal solo gamer itch, you know, without forcing me to enter into kind of the tropes of an MMO. Path of Exile isn't even an MMO at all, but it is designed for online multiplayer co-op. Now, in towns, towns will feel a little bit like an MMO because you'll see a number of other player characters. But as soon as you step outside of the town, all players play in their own individual instanced versions of the campaign levels. Although I do believe that you can invite someone into your instance so that they can play through a level in co-op with you. But I haven't tried that yet. I've not tried online multiplayer co-op. If anybody's interested in doing that with me, let me know on the forums, and you know, we'll see if we can set up a time to make that happen. I'd be interested in checking it out, and it's a game, like if you can't tell, that I really enjoy. So unlike most free online games, Path of Exile can be played entirely as a solo game, during which you won't even see other player characters, except when you go to the town to trade items or advance a quest or specifically pursue PvP or co-op. Now, I have to say that one thing I don't like about Path of Exile is the fact that it is always online and unpausable. I don't remember running into any problems with the server. I've always been able to play when I've wanted to, unless for some reason I don't have internet access or my internet access is lousy, such as, you know, at places that I'm playing on my laptop with that have bad Wi-Fi. Also, since the game is still in open beta, it updates quite frequently. Even when I was playing the game every day, it still seemed to have an update that I had to sit through for 3 to 5 minutes about once a week. And now, as I play it, I only get around to it. Well, I've been playing Neverwinter Nights 2 since my birthday, so I haven't played Path of Exile except for maybe one or two times since the middle of April. But even as I was slowing down before that and playing like maybe once a week, I could pretty much count on sitting through a 3 to 5 minute update before being able to play the game. So just be aware of that. But with plans to officially launch the game sometime this year, I would assume that these updates will eventually become less frequent. And they are a very small price to pay for the experience you get. Of greater annoyance is the fact that I can't pause. You know, sometimes a guy's got to go to the bathroom. So I've learned to either use up a portal scroll, which I feel like they're plentiful. I never feel like I'm in trouble or running out of portal scrolls. So I either use a portal scroll to go back to town so I can run to the bathroom and pee, or I try to find a spot in the dungeon I've cleared and hope that my guy isn't a bloody pile when I get back from the bathroom. But usually once you clear an area, you know, there's it's not like an endless stream of monsters that are flooding into every area of the game. So I have found success doing that as well. Or retreating to an area I've already cleared, and then getting up and taking a break, you know, to go to the bathroom or get a drink or something. The story premise. The basic concept of the game is that you've been convicted of a crime of some sort, which is explained at the beginning when you pick what type of character you're playing. They have a little opening monologue where they explain their little backstory and, you know, what crime they've committed or been accused of committing. The idea is that you've been convicted unjustly in at least some cases, depending on the character class you choose. A couple others are like, yeah, I did it, you know. But you've all been sentenced to exile in the realm of Rayclast. Your goal is to survive and somehow eventually escape the realm and regain your freedom. You just start out washed up on a beach and it's like, oh crap, what is this place? And I got to, you know, your first thought is just survival. I mean, it's this very kind of stark feeling from the very beginning of just like you are abandoned to a strange, lowly, lonely, haunted, scorched wasteland. And it's this very, almost kind of, this sense of despair that they capture really well from the get-go, that they really maintain for quite a bit of the experience so far. Now, although the idea is not communicated in any of the dialogue or plot text, the design and overall tone of Path of Exile evokes classical concepts of hell or purgatory. Exiles are sometimes referred to as the damned, and the undead are everywhere, and the scorched landscape is inhabited by creatures that might have spent a little bit of time in Clive Barker's head, I'm not sure. While interesting enough to earn my attention as the plot advances, between tons and tons and tons of hack and slash action, the story is clearly not the main draw to the experience, and the aesthetics of the game are more likely to provoke feeling, I think, than thinking. Still, I'm only about 10 hours into the game, and there seems to be plenty of room for them to do some interesting things, philosophically speaking. I wouldn't be surprised if by the end of the game, we learn that all of the exiles are actually dead, and Rayclast actually is some sort of cursed afterlife. I don't know. It just gives the feeling so strongly of that kind of classical, although I would say unbiblical in many cases, that classical idea of hell or that classical idea of purgatory. If this ends up being the case that we find out at the end of the game that all the exiles are dead, well, there may be good cause at that point for thought or conversation about the nature of hell, you know, its duration and its common elements, what it will look like for those that are there. Or conversation about the concept of purgatory as put forth by Catholicism. Path of Exile was the first game I've ever played during an open beta. Now, in the past, I hadn't quite understood what that meant because I'm just not smart, especially not when it comes to technology. And I was like, open beta, that sounds really weird and technical. And I thought I might be required to fill out feedback forms and surveys to play a game in open beta or perform some sort of boring bug testing routine, you know. You are in all likelihood not as ill-informed as I am. But just in case you've never participated in an open beta because you were unsure of what it involved, I can say that at least in this case, there seems to be nothing required of me but to enjoy the game for as much as I'd like. Although I know the developers do value feedback during this stage if you wish to give it. Now, before wrapping up, I have to give serious props to my bro-in-law, Sean Corbett, who pointed me to this game. He also pointed me to Battle for Wesnoth last year, which ended up being one of my favorite Summer of Free games last summer. So, Sean, you rock, sir. Path of Exile is a game I would certainly pay for, and it's insane. It's insane, people, that this game is completely free with zero temptation built in to get me to pay for anything extra unless I want literally useless bells and whistles. It plays great, looks great, has a fantastically dark and haunting fantasy feel that may even lead to some worthwhile contemplation of our eternal destinies in the endgame. For right now, I don't have any real reason to think that, which is why I'm giving it a lower relevance score. But guys, give this game a try. Quality 9.0 out of 10, and that's regardless of the fact that it's free. Relevance 6.5 out of 10. Well, I'm sitting here talking with Matt McKinney, who I'm super stoked is our new correspondent for. He's started the Trek Talk segment on the podcast for us, and I asked him to sit down and nerd out with me and school me a little bit on Star Trek, as we've both recently seen the Star Trek movie Into Darkness. Matt, thanks for hanging out with me.
Thanks for having me, Tater.
Okay, so first, just a little bit of kind of background. You've been a Star Trek fan, I'm assuming, for a pretty stinking long time. What was the first Star Trek you watched that really was that made you feel like, oh man, I've gotta see more of this?
I think it was when I was about 12. They were starting to run Star Trek: The Next Generation reruns on the syndication, like every night, like 5 or 6 o'clock. And I was just at home and I started watching them, and I saw the commercial for one, which is ironically not that good of an episode. It was called Symbiosis. It was the episode where they get a planet of drug addicts and then another planet of drug dealers. Really heavy-handed symbolism, but it still got me into the show, and I started watching from there, and then I started watching the old reruns, and I got caught up, and then I started watching the original series, and then I really got into things with Deep Space Nine. That's when I really, it went from just a show I liked into a whole universe I liked.
Cool. And so, Deep Space Nine being your favorite of the of all the various TV shows.
Yeah, although again, they're all great in their own way. But yeah, Deep Space Nine mostly because that was the one when they started really using continuity, and suddenly you were seeing people making references when things would appear that you had seen in the other series, and it wasn't, for example, Picard dealing with an individual person he had met. But we saw someone Picard had met, or we met aliens that they had dealt with. And so it just felt more like it was a real world because it wasn't just a bunch of characters being thrown on stage we'd already seen. It was more like the tapestry felt like a real world. And that really just expanded it into something much bigger to me. And I'm a sucker for any really complex, intricate world where I think where you can read the old places you've been to and see a lot of depth there.
Yeah, I would agree. I think that a lot of modern sci-fi and you know, maybe even modern television in general owe a show like Deep Space Nine, or by all accounts, I don't know from personal experience, but Babylon 5, that really developed this kind of serialized storytelling outside of like soap opera drama that demanded that a viewer invest in the show and really know the characters and go along on that journey. Now you've got like a whole like web series that you do on YouTube. Tell me what that is in kind of a nutshell.
Well, basically, if you've seen something like the Spoonie Experiment or the Nostalgia Critic online, I very much modeled my style after them, which is, it's called TOS, and if you just search those words, just the letters, TOS space TOS, you'll find it, and it's just me talking about each episode of the show is an episode of Star Trek, except for sometimes I'll do like a top 10 list, but in general, and I just take a bad episode, my catchphrase is, I love Star Trek, which is why I hate bad Star Trek, and I just tear apart the flaws, and I do point out the good things if they have them. And I'm just tearing apart the flaws. I try to be funny. I don't know how funny I am, but I'm trying. one of the things I borrowed from the other people is you often take like a clip of some other show or whatever and just throw it in, and it's very meme heavy. And I just, it's roughly about 20 minutes long, and I just tear apart the bad episodes and make fun of them. And occasionally I'll talk about what I like about Star Trek.
Nice. Yeah, I got to say, like, on the humor front, it takes an unusual, quirky sense of humor to get me to actually, like, laugh out loud. And I was laughing when I saw the first one I saw. I can't remember which one it was. It was, what's the one where you rip your face off?
I think it was Prophecy. I think it was the one with the Klingon pilgrims on Voyager.
Okay.
That seemed like, yeah, it was. Because it was the end of the episode and Neelix had just been romantic. And Neelix is not someone you want to see being romantic.
That's right. That's right. Yeah, that was great. That was great. Okay, so you're a huge Star Trek fan. You know, now you've seen the second of these new J.J. Abrams movies, and my guess is, I think you were really generous in the review that you sent in that we played on the show, because I could tell that, like, you were trying to basically say, if you're this kind of person, you'll probably like it, go check it out. If you're this kind of person, you might not. I sense that maybe you might be in the latter category a little bit more, and we're just kind of being kind in some respects. I mean, how did you really feel, for you personally, for your tastes, about the first J.J. Abrams Star Trek, and especially this most recent one?
Well, with both of them, it's very much the same thing, and my own opinion is it's very in the middle of the road, because when you look at what it does, it's one of those shows that does some dumb things really, really well, and other things really, really poorly. And when you're in for the fun and the action and just a popcorn romp, they're really good at that. And they have good characters that you like in general. There are a couple they get wrong. But the main problem for me is that they're playing in the universe, and then they kind of just violate the rules of that universe, and it gets hard to take when they do it again and again. And one of the big things for me in this movie was the geography was all over the place. And what I mean by that is not just like they went north where they should have gone south or something like that, but the idea of there are two neighboring powers, and neighboring in the galactic sense, so we're not talking just the next system over, Kronos and Earth. Those are the home planets. They're making calls on what's their communicators, basically a cell phone, from home planet to home planet. They are using advanced technology to beam from home planet to home planet. It seems like they're warping there in about 20 minutes. And it's more than just a technical thing. It tears it apart because you find it hard to believe that these powers would build up any kind of a war, a cold war or even a hot war, when you can literally just go next door and mess with their stuff.
Hmm. So you feel like with the way they were presenting it in the movie, with them being so close to each other, Earth and Kronos, that they would have been at war with the Klingons by now or a long time ago.
Yeah. Because basically they seem like they're practically next door neighbors on how easy it is to contact the other one.
Yeah.
And you just wonder why there hasn't been either war or peace in a very solid way by now. And it just makes everything easy. Like, how many times did the Enterprise get knocked out, its engines get knocked out or sabotaged, or the other ship get its power knocked out? And every time it did, it was always right above the planet they were going to anyway. It's like for all these things, all these times that the ships get attacked and their engines are lost, they get knocked out right where they already need to be. And it felt like this was built on a lot of coincidence.
Mm. Now, before we go any further, I want to say to those listening, we are about to go into major, major, major spoilers for Star Trek Into Darkness. So if I'm on my game, I'll try to remember to put in the show notes when this segment ends in the show, but I'm probably not going to be on my game. So just kind of skip ahead. Yeah, you have been warned. But anyway, so let's go ahead and dive into the spoilers now. We've got Khan in this movie. I didn't follow a lot of the kind of rumors or anything like that before I saw the movie. Was this kind of something that had already been leaked, or were you surprised by it, or do you think other people were surprised by it, or what's your take on that?
Well, I've heard a lot of people say they already knew. I don't think it was so much leaked, but I think it was just an obvious twist that everyone saw coming.
Okay.
Or at least a lot of people saw it coming, not everyone. But to my knowledge, it wasn't leaked. I think it was a secret they were trying to keep. But Khan is kind of a no-brainer because he is pretty much the most famous villain and one of the most effective villains in Star Trek. And while I don't think that this guy, Benedict Cumberbatch, I liked him, but he was no Ricardo Montalban. But I do think he was an effective con. Mostly, it feels like they didn't do enough with him in this movie. Which is why I'm glad they kept him alive so they can do more.
Yeah, I did like that he broke that chick's leg. Walking past her.
One thing they were very effective with is the brutality of Khan and the cleverness of Khan. What they really missed out on, and some of this it makes sense if you think about it in the story, but it's still missing, is the charm of Khan. I don't know, have you ever seen the original series episode he was in?
Space Seed?
Yeah.
Isn't that what it's called? It's been so long, and I'm not even sure I've seen the whole thing.
Okay. But, yeah, he's very... In fact, when they first freed him, they're not sure that he was an old... He was a villain from the 1990s. Boy, I remember that when we saw him in the space. Yeah, they didn't know for sure, and he was actually very charming and likable, and of course then he would attack the ship and everything, but in this one, he really didn't seem to have much charm. He was Hannibal Lecter at best. That was his most charming. But he was Hannibal Lecter in the cell. And he was very intense and brutal, and he did that very well. But he was missing that element. But I think, I can argue that in-universe that this is a man who has already been betrayed. You know, Khan in the original series had just been unthawed and was trying to finagle and charm his way in. This Khan, all his cards were on the table already, so there was no need to charm. So I can see that makes sense, but I would like to see him try to be charming in the future, because that's a very interesting thing, to have the villain who's likable in his own way.
Yeah. Now, do you think, you know, you've brought up some of these kind of like comparisons, you know, and how things really ought to be if they're going to line up with the continuity that's been established in the old universe, because really what J.J. Abrams is saying here, and I single him out. Obviously, he's more than just a single person on this creative team. But what the Abrams verse is doing is saying this is the same Star Trek universe. It just goes on to a different timeline, starting with this incident around Kirk's birth. And there are times when I'm sorry. Go ahead.
And I like what they did, because they addressed how this happened in a different way. That someone else had expanded out and stumbled across his ship and had unfrozen him. So I did like that they mentioned that. But I think my girlfriend put it really well when it said, if you're going to diverge, then diverge and tell some new stories, not just repackage the old. I mean, I like the old stuff, but this one, especially at the end of the movie, they're actually quoting lines out of Wrath of Khan.
Yeah.
And they're just putting people in the same situation but flip-flopping their roles. And that's not creative. That's a find and replace.
Yeah. Well, and it's kind of like it's almost going, I mean, obviously not near to this extent, but it's almost going in that direction of like Indiana Jones and the Kingdom of the Crystal Skull, where it's like kind of like, oh, hey, remember this good part from the previous movies, you know, instead of forging new territory. And you know, you'd mentioned, I believe, if I remember correctly, that you weren't really fond of the Khan scream from Spock. That didn't bother me. I mean, I thought like, you know, it wasn't
I laughed out loud.
Is that the part you were talking about in your review that you said, you know, you weren't going to give a spoiler, but it was the part that was supposed to be serious, but you laughed out loud?
Yes. I was laughing because part of it is the Khan scream. People have joked about it since it came out in 1982, and it's been its own meme. It's been a joke, a running gag that people do to show how cheesy Star Trek is. And then you try to trot that out in a honestly much less dramatically significant moment and try to make it serious. And, I mean, in the original movie, Wrath of Khan, it was an intense moment, and it still spoiled the moment. And this movie wasn't nearly as intense in the moment. Plus, instead of using this like to hang in the air, they use this as a transition moment right into an action scene.
So you didn't like, you thought even the original Khan scream was silly. Is that what I'm hearing from you?
Yeah, in a moment, yes. I thought it was a big weak part of the movie, and it was a great movie, don't get me wrong. Of course, I like this movie. Nowhere near as good, but yeah, I thought that was a weakness because it was an intense moment, but it just failed because it's so over the top. Because Khan was saying this like really quiet, serious, personal, you know, he was getting his vengeance and he was getting under Kirk's skin, and all of a sudden Kirk responds screaming, Khan!
But wasn't that right after his son died or something? It's been forever since I've seen it.
No, his son didn't die in that movie at all. all that had happened there was Kirk had been abandoned inside this dead moon, and as far as Khan knew, the Enterprise was long gone. And so Khan's saying, no one knows you're here, I'm going to leave you fly, and less than that. And then Kirk just screams, Khan!
Oh,
he might have even been playing that out for Khan's sake, if he had a secret going on.
Was he standing over a body was he standing over a body when he did that? I have this weird memory of William Shatner screaming at the camera hanging above him while there's a body underneath him.
Not near Khan.
Okay.
Only two people died in the scene right before that.
Okay.
And then Chekhov was wounded, and the two people were people Kirk didn't know, and they both got vaporized.
See, this is why
so
I need you.
The only body there was.
This is why I need you to come on and do Star Trek segments, because I'm like, you know, I've got a soft spot for Trek, but I mean, it's nothing like I know a lot of fans out there.
Yeah, I dwell in that sad world. But don't get me wrong. I mean, the flaws you harp on, but there were some really good things in this. I like that they brought in some of the deeper universe, like Section 31,
mm-hmm.
which was, in fact, I'm going to do it. My next Trek talk after this will be about Section 31, so I won't go into detail now.
Cool.
But it was a nice thing to see this deeper part of the world. And there were a couple little references. You saw things like the ship from Enterprise was on their models of historical ships. So it's a nice touch. Again, I love those touchstones that remind you, even in this reboot, it's still part of a larger world.
Mm. Now, do you think that we might be not as critical, or we might be, you know, like hardcore fans like yourself might be more forgiving of some of these moments that, you know, are kind of like untrue to the original continuity if they would have not connected this at all to the previous continuity? I mean, do you think it would have been a more satisfying choice, at least for you, maybe not for other fans in general, but just speaking for you, would it have been a more satisfying choice to just say, you know what? For screw the old continuity, well, maybe not screw it, but, you know, you can enjoy it. It's on DVD. Yeah. You can get the Blu-rays and all that kind of stuff. We're doing something totally new. We're going to use the same names, and they're going to be similar in many ways to the old characters, but we are not in any way tying ourselves down to that previous universe. Do you think that would have been a more enjoyable way to go?
Well, it's hard to say because different fans have different attitudes. I've never minded the idea of going in a different direction, but I don't like, there's two characters I think that get flat out wrong in these reboots. That would be Kirk and Uhura.
Hmm.
And they were even worse in this than in the first one. Kirk is still just, he's irresponsible, he's like a frat boy, and all people can argue with is, yeah, he had a different past, of course he's irresponsible, but it's like, then he's not the same character, so highlight he's not the same character. So basically what Kirk is he's his own caricature.
Hmm.
You know, the original Kirk, he was a ladies' man, but he was not just a horn dog who followed around every short skirt he could find.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they've exaggerated that part to make a joke, but when you make that so much part of the character, you make the character a joke.
Mm.
So instead of having a joke about him, you really, and Uhura was always a very level-headed person. There wasn't much about her in the original series, and I have no problem expanding the role, but as you saw in this movie, she is so unprofessional, she can barely do her job because her boyfriend's involved. And even in the middle of a crucial mission, she has to start having an argument with him.
Now, see, okay, now I'll give you that, like, when that argument started happening, I was like, really, you know? But as far as, like, being, like, unprofessional and Kirk being, you know, kind of like this, you know, this loser frat boy and stuff like that, I'm coming, I guess, more from the Farscape Battlestar Galactica school of thought, where I like people mm-hmm. on a ship, and they all have different roles, but they are completely undisciplined, and it's just a horrible thing to watch. Now, I grant you that doesn't fit this world that they're trying to put forth, because they're trying to say, well, this is, you know, this wonderful organization called Starfleet, and they're trained and they're noble, and, you know, we should look up to them and stuff. So I understand, you know, that looking at these characters, like, you know, really they shouldn't be this unprofessional. It makes sense in Battlestar.
Yeah,
it makes
Moya.
It makes sense on Moya. It makes sense on the Galactica. It doesn't make sense here. However, I guess I'm willing to forgive that, because I'm so after watching shows like Farscape and Battlestar Galactica, I just can't go back to classic Star Trek where everyone is just freaking getting along and doing their job so professionally. I'm just like, I guess I'm a sick person because I really enjoy the dysfunction.
No, I get that. And, well, conflict is the center of drama. And Gene Roddenberry's idea that there's no conflict among the perfect humans, that really choked down a lot of life in early Star Trek.
Mm-hmm.
I know, I fully agree. My problem is, like, for example, with Uhura, it's almost like they're afraid to say she's wrong about anything.
Mm.
So instead of being a flawed character, it's more like they make her flawed and then act like this is the way women are supposed to be.
Mm.
And she's obnoxious and she, you know, she'll just do whatever she wants and then she's right because she's Uhura and, you know, people watch her in a short skirt, so therefore she's always right.
Mm.
And that, I guess that's what I don't like is I'm glad that in this movie they started to call Kirk on the carpet, but then they really have that idea that Kirk needed to learn about being a captain.
Yeah. Now, you mentioned in your review, you know, that you thought it was kind of silly that we're all trying to pretend that Starfleet isn't a military organization, you know? And
yeah, that's been an old debate of Roddenberry's.
And in my review, I kind of reacted to that, but from a different angle, in that, you know, should we call this franchise Star Trek? I mean, now, I understand, like I said in my thoughts on the movie, that, you know, it would be a moronic decision from a marketing standpoint to not call it Star Trek anymore, you know.
Yeah.
But does it make much sense to call it Star Trek?
Well, and I agree with you on that, because it wasn't until the very end of the movie that they went on their actual 5-year mission.
Yeah.
And that's the thing, is the original Star Trek, well, part of the appeal was it could be any kind of show. I mean, sometimes they would fight Romulans and defend the borders, and the next episode they'd go to the planet of Roman people.
Mm-hmm.
And they were just exploring and charting out the planet. Sometimes they just encountered an anomaly. Sometimes they were sent to answer a peace treaty and mediate the problem.
Mm-hmm.
And I like that they kind of did whatever, and that's I agree with you, that Star Trek should be down to whatever, and that lets you open up all sorts of storylines. And then you don't have to just keep mirroring what was already done. You can actually just come up with a new idea, a new alien race.
Yeah.
I have to say, I really did like the look of the aliens from the very beginning of the movie, too.
Mm, yeah.
I liked the way they looked.
The Skrull worshippers?
And actually, yeah. And I thought that scene was actually a really effective scene until we got to the very end and we found out that's another issue of Star Trek. And it's kind of wrapped in with the military thing. Is the way the Prime Directive was used, and I thought they were getting cast in. I was actually excited, so I thought, okay, well, I thought the Enterprise had been sent to stop this volcano, and they had to be secret about it, which is good. That's what Starfleet should be doing. But instead, it turns out that Kirk wasn't just violating his orders to when he went to save Spock and said, let him die. Apparently, the whole crew was violating orders and trying to stop this volcano.
Mm.
And that just makes Starfleet, and it was like that in the original show, that the Prime Directive built, I mean, there was an episode where Picard and his crew stood there and watched the atmosphere dissipate off a planet because of a natural disaster. The people had not made some sort of new super weapon that did it. It was a natural disaster, killed the entire planet, and they stood there and watched it.
Hmm.
And they had a solemn ritual thing. Let us remember how important the Prime Directive is. And to me, that's heinous.
Mm.
You know, and, I mean, I understand the whole idea of the Prime Directive is we don't let them see our ship, we don't tell them there are aliens, because that makes sense, it's logical, and it makes a good dramatic limit for your characters. But then, and Voyager is probably the worst about this, is they would treat it like it's an excuse to not do anything.
Mm.
Instead of an obstacle to get around to explain why we did something.
Yeah. I would love to see... Sorry, go ahead.
Go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say, I would love to see, maybe this is just like the rebel in me that, you know, it just wants to make sure that, you know, we just leave old Star Trek behind. But I would love to see in the future movie them do, you know, the exploration thing. But of course, I don't want to, you know, they can't go back to classic, you know, what if Star Trek and let that be. I think as you put it, and I really love those classifications, by the way, of what if and what now. And I think what we've been seeing a lot in these first two movies is these are what now kinds of stories. A little bit of what if to get the ball rolling, but then it's what now the rest of the way. And so
I agree. Yeah, you have to earn the what now.
Yeah. And I'd be interested in them, you know, going on this 5-year mission and having some what if to kick things off. But I would love the what now to be so crazy, you know, and if they bring the freaking Prime Directive up again, I think that that Kirk and whoever else just needs to rebel against that so much and for all the right reasons that Starfleet just totally has to reevaluate everything that they are. The organization gets totally restructured, redefined, and really take this franchise in a genuinely new direction. I think that would be really cool.
Yes, and I don't think that would be a bad idea if you did it with thought. But the problem is, it seems like J.J. Abrams wants to play to the lowest common denominator. He just wants to make popcorn movies.
Yeah.
And I have nothing against popcorn movies, but Star Trek has never been a popcorn franchise.
Mm, that's true.
You know, Star Wars is popcorn. It has meaning, but the meaning is very basic. It's good versus evil. And
yeah.
In fact, that was one of the flaws of the prequels, was they kept trying to make things too dark and serious and with too much depth. Instead of just having, here are good guys, here are bad guys, let's see them go through their things, and Anakin turns to the dark side, you know, and a lot of people said that J.J. Abrams' Star Treks are just his early Star Wars movies, and I think there's some validity to that.
Mm.
And again, Star Trek has never been short on action, but it shouldn't be action for its own sake.
Yeah. So what's next?
And I think that's...
What's next for the next movie? Do you think that we're going to see Kirk and crew go on the quest for V'ger?
Well, I hope they stop recycling their old villains, especially V'ger was a pretty lame villain.
Yeah.
I would like to see him, like you said, I agree. I want to see him do something new. Even like if they have a fight with the Klingons, the nice thing is there was only like 4 episodes of the original series that they did Klingons at all.
Hmm.
And then there were some times where they mentioned Klingons, or they had a fight with a Klingon that you only saw on the ship on the view screen, but, you know, you weren't actually interacting with them. And, you know, that there actually was a period in the original series early on where they had war declared, but in that same episode, they actually had a treaty forced on them by powerful aliens.
Hmm.
And so it kind of forced this bubbling war into a Cold War, because they had someone step in from outside who could overpower both governments and force them to get along. And, of course, it was a little artificial, but it eventually led the franchise down the road to a genuine peace treaty, and the Klingons became a great ally race.
Mm.
And I suspect Klingons will be very prevalent in the next movie, which will be fine if they do it well, as long as they don't just recycle another story.
Yeah.
But if they do Klingons in a different way.
Yeah.
And if it's true Star Trek, then they will do it through peace and understanding, and they'll get over their conflict. And that's Star Trek when it's doing things right, is we find the best in the other people. And there's nothing wrong with action, but, again, it's not just kill them all and sort them out later.
Yeah. I don't know. I don't want them to be I don't want them to ever be friends with the Klingons. Because then you just got to have power creep. Then it's just power creep. You got to find something else, and then it's the Borg, and then we get a Borg crew member, and then what's left? Then we got, I don't know what they came up with after the Borg. This, you know, let's just have those Klingons be freaking nasty, you know, for the.
And I will say, if they ever come to peace, it shouldn't be easy.
Yeah.
In fact, probably my personal favorite Star Trek movie, even though I acknowledge Star Trek 2 is probably the better one, is Star Trek 6. And the main reason I like it, other than my own sentimental things, is that Kirk and the crew actually had prejudices, and they had to get over them.
Mm.
And they felt like human beings for once.
Yeah.
And I like that. Of course, Star Trek 2 was full of Kirk's flaws, too.
Mm.
And that's good drama to have a flawed character.
Yeah.
Like I said, we just don't want to celebrate the flaws. That's why I didn't like the way they treated Uhura and Kirk. It just seems like you're supposed to celebrate them and laugh with them instead of get over these things.
Yeah. That's a good point. Good point. Well, it's been awesome talking to you about this, so we'll definitely have to do this again because it was just way too much fun.
Oh.
But I will look
forward. I would love to.
I will look forward to your next Trek Talk segment, and hope people will go and check out POS, TOS. Did I say that right?
POS, TOS.
Okay, yeah. Over on YouTube. So again, Matt, thank you so much for talking to me.
Thank you, Peter.
This is Professor Allen from Allen's Eyes and Ears at eyesandearsblog.blogspot.com, and I'm answering Peter's call to get some Doctor Who content on the podcast, and I'm offering a review of an audio presentation featuring the Doctor that I recently reviewed on my blog. But first, I must give the shortest possible history of the show. Doctor Who debuted on British TV in 1963, and the title character was portrayed by William Hartnell. After 3 seasons, the actor's health had deteriorated, forcing him to retire. the executives at the show and at the BBC came up with a genius solution to this problem, allowing for the character to regularly regenerate, allowing the show to continue beyond the tenure of any one actor. So this classic version of the series ran for 26 seasons, 7 different actors portraying the Doctor. For context, the current series of New Who features the 11th Doctor. Well, in October of 1987, a 4-part story called Paradise Tower aired on the BBC, featuring the 7th Doctor actor Sylvester McCoy. The next year, as the BBC often does, they released a paperback novelization of the story, written by Stephen Wyatt, who also wrote the original TV script. An unabridged audio version of that novelization was released just a few years ago, performed by Bonnie Langford, who played the Doctor's companion Melanie in the original TV version of the story. It's this audio version that I'm reviewing here. So, after an exhausting series of adventures, the Doctor and Mel decide to take a vacation. As any fan of science fiction knows, this will not turn out well. All Melanie really wants to do is spend a few days lounging by a swimming pool, so they fly to the 22nd century's leading luxury apartment complex, Paradise Towers. What they find is a building fallen into disrepair, and a divided population. The Doctor and Mel split amidst the confusion, and they agree to meet up later at the rooftop pool. The apartment complex features roaming gangs of color-coordinated girls with names like Binliner and Fire Escape. There are caretakers and lots of female residents, and a robotic cleaning machine's gone awry, gone murderously awry. The only free male in the complex is Pex, all of the other men having fled to fight a war. Pex appoints himself Mel's protector, but he's less than capable in the role, adding a bit of needed comic relief to an otherwise pretty dark story. In what is a pretty cliche plot, at this point in time, but was more original 25-plus years ago, the AI that runs the building has decided that the filthy human parasites must be destroyed, as they have been the cause for the building's current shabbiness. It is discovered that the original architect of the building never really liked the idea of humans living in any of his designs, so he uses booby traps in the buildings to declare war on the human occupants. But the divided people are brought together by the Doctor, and they fight back against their less-than-human enemies. A sacrifice is made, victory is achieved, and the building's reign of terror over its residents is ended. The outcome is predictable, but the story has a nice sense of pacing and plenty of action. But overall, there's very little about this particular story that is other than an average, ordinary adventure tale, although Langford brings a lot of refreshing energy to her narration, and none of the major guest characters are terribly memorable. Only Pex and Binliner rise above the rest as individualized characters with their own arcs. So I would not necessarily recommend a newbie start with this particular adventure of Paradise Towers, either the TV or this audio version. But between the BBC and an audio company called Big Finish, there are literally scores, probably hundreds, of audio adventures out there featuring the Doctor, mostly narrated by actors who have portrayed the Doctor, or actors or actresses who've portrayed a companion, as this one was. Well, I thank Peter for asking for Who-related content, and look forward to providing some more over time, and certainly invite other Whovians among the Spirit Blade community to do so as well.
It is time to be happy. It is time for a contest. Fabulous prizes. A winner is you.
I want to thank Dave Mattingly of Blackworm Publishing, your home of experimental fiction and role-playing. Blackworm is giving away another novel on our show. If you guys haven't yet, be sure to check out Blackworm, and that's Worm, W-Y-R-M, blackworm.com. The content there, it's novels, it's gaming stuff, it's aimed at geeks in general, but it's run by a believer. Dave Mattingly also helped found the Christian Gamers Guild, so consider supporting his efforts by seeing what he and his writers are up to over at blackworm.com. Today, Dave Mattingly and Blackworm are giving away Dark Halo, a novel by Christopher Kakoski. The description reads, "In a town besieged by shadowy demonic forces, a father races against time to save his family. 35-year-old Landon Paddock has deserted his wife and daughter, abandoned his business, and secluded himself in his late parents' southern Indiana ranch. but he's barely lapsed into a drunken coma when a mysterious winged stranger appears during a violent lightning storm, chasing him out into the maddening night with his estranged 15-year-old daughter. As layer after layer of reality is dissolved by a series of violent encounters, the only way to survive might be for Landon to band together with the family he destroyed to make one last stand against a sinister army of unthinkable magnitude. Hope, family, and redemption lay in the outcome. For a chance to win a copy of Dark Halo, you got to do one or more of the following. Number one, send an email containing your first and last name with the subject title contest to Pater, P-A-E-T-E-R, at spiritblade.net and answer this question. Do you feel your geek interests make you more accepted, less accepted, or treated no differently among the Christians in your life? Do you feel your geek interests make you more accepted, less accepted, or treated no differently among the Christians in your life? Only one entry of this type per person is permitted. Number two, you can send an email containing your first and last name with the subject title contest to me, Pater, at spiritblade.net, and indicate that you're a new listener as of May 16th, 2013. Only one entry of this type per person is permitted as well. But the last way, number three, have your first and last name credited as the referral source in a contest entry from a new listener. So, in other words, a new listener that sends in a contest entry mentions you, your first and last name, they're going to need to supply your email address as well. Sorry about that. Anyway, multiple entries of this type are permitted. Go work the system, guys. You can really get a lot of entries that way if you tell people in a community that you're a part of that enjoy these kinds of books and this kind of fiction about this contest. Man, if they mention your name, you could get a ton of entries. Anyway, you got to submit all of your entries by 11:59 p.m. Eastern Standard Time on June 5th, 2013. I'm going to randomly select the winner of the contest and announce the winner on this podcast following the contest deadline. Be sure to check out our show notes for more information and a link to our full contest rules. In addition to possibly winning a prize, participating in these contests helps give me feedback that improves the show for you. And the more contest participants, the better prizes we can get for future contests, the more listeners we get for the show. All kinds of winning all around. So I really encourage you to participate and tell others about the contest as well. Again, the deadline is June 5th. Good luck. Well, I want to thank Matt McKinney for talking with me and Professor Allen for sending in that great review and history of Doctor Who. Guys, I want your feedback, input. I want to hear from you. Request a review. Give me your thoughts, questions, whatever. It all helps me make the show better. Go to spiritblade.net/underground to record a message with your computer. Send me an email pater@spiritblade.net or call 206-350-1226. And if you want to help make sure Spirit Blade Productions can keep doing what we're doing or do more of it, both faster and better, you're invited to make a donation of any amount, anytime, or become a part of the Spirit Blade Insider Program and get monthly exclusive goodies. For more information, check out spiritblade.net/donate. All right, and once again, just as by way of announcement, we need an additional tech admin for the Christian Geek Central forums. There is a boatload of stuff, an avalanche of activity that I want to make happen, but I am waiting on tweaking the color scheme for the forums. It's probably a relatively simple thing for you, whoever you are out there. Knowing CSS, I'm told by our current tech admin, would be helpful for this. But like I said, we just need to finish tweaking that color scheme. Then I can link the forums to the Christian Geek Central site that's in waiting. I can launch the alpha version of the site, and then I can start inviting podcasters and bloggers to bring their content to Christian Geek Central. And there's just all kinds of stuff that will begin snowballing and happening once we can launch the alpha version of Christian Geek Central. It's all just waiting on tweaking the color scheme of the forums. I can't believe it. So we've been kind of in a holding pattern for about I think like a month now. Maybe by the time this podcast airs, a month and a half. I don't know. It feels like forever. So please email me if you're interested in helping out, even if you don't want to stick around and be an ongoing tech admin for the forums. If you're familiar with CSS and you want to help us finish adjusting the color scheme just so that it matches more fully what I've got going on with the Christian Geek Central site, let me know. I'll give you access to the Christian Geek Central site and access to the tech admin privileges on the forums. And, man, we can get this thing done and we can get things happening. All right. Next week, guys, the second annual listener-created episode of the Spirit Blade Underground podcast. You're not going to hear me blab a single word on that show. It's all you guys. We're going to have reviews of Avengers Arena, the Avengers Arena comic series, and the Ravine comic book as well, plus a look at biblical finances to go along with the Summer of Free. Us geeks can really let our spending get out of hand pretty easily. I'm definitely speaking of myself here. So this will be a great segment, I think, to give us some perspective on money and our possessions as we pursue geeking out. In the meantime, thanks so much for making time for this show. Have a great week. I hope you'll join me next time here on the Spirit Blade Underground podcast as we continue to geek out and seek the truth.
Spirit Blade Underground is a community-supported endeavor of Spirit Blade Productions. This podcast is produced by Peter Frenson with support and contributions from the Spirit Blade Underground community. For more information about the Spirit Blade Underground, visit spiritblade.net/underground. Or for information about the variety of activities and products by Spirit Blade Productions, visit spiritblade.net. Thank you for listening.